Okay, team.
Good afternoon. Hello, everyone. So we'll pull our attention up here to the front here. Just want to go ahead and get started. I would like to give a special thank you to Bonhams for sponsoring this plenary, and also thank the University of Iowa Libraries and the Iowa State University Library for hosting us here at Hampshire Auditorium this evening. And now I'd like to introduce Chuck Swanson, Director of Hampshire, to welcome us to this lovely space. Chuck? He was here a moment ago. I'm sure he'll be right back. All right. Cherry, is Cherry Williams here, because we can. Cherry, may I invite you up as the representative of the Leib committees to read us a tribute to Dan Leib, and perhaps then we will catch up with Chuck afterwards.
Sorry, I couldn't find a longer way around. it is my honor to read to you the ACRL Rare Books and Manuscript Section Memorial Resolution honoring Daniel J. Leib. It is with deep respect and sadness that the Association of College and Research Libraries and the Rare Books and Manuscript Section acknowledges the passing of Daniel J. Leib. Whereas Daniel J. Leib's vision and commitment in joining with his wife, Catherine, in establishing the Catherine Kyes Leib and Daniel J. Leib American Book Prize's current exhibition awards has enriched the professional lives of the RBMS community in wide-ranging and innumerable ways since its inception, and whereas the Catherine Kyes Leib and Daniel J. Leib American Book Prize's current Exhibition Catalog Awards has provided an opportunity for members of the Rare Books and Manuscripts section to articulate and demonstrate the scholarly practice of Rare Books and Manuscripts librarianship, and whereas Daniel J. Leib was a valued and respected member of the library community at large, and particularly of the Rare Books and Manuscripts section of ACRL, let it be resolved that the members of the Rare Books and Manuscripts section of ACRL join his family, friends, and associates in celebrating his life and accomplishments and remembering Daniel J. Leib as a man who lived life boldly and colorfully, was renowned for his hearty, reverberating laugh, and his deep love and devotion to his wife, his children, and his grandchildren, all of whom adored him. He will be deeply missed. Please join me in recognizing the contributions of Daniel J. Leib to the fabric of our RBMS community.
Thank you, Terry. And now I will welcome Chuck Swanson to the stage to welcome us to this gorgeous space that we're enjoying tonight.
Thank you so much, Julie. Welcome, everybody. We're so glad you're here. And I don't know if you know the whole story about Hampshire, but just want to quickly tell you that the original Hampshire opened in 1972 south of here, and we were hit with a flood in 2008. For 8 years, we were without a building, designing and really constructing this brand new auditorium, and we just opened last year. So what do you all think? So I want to officially welcome you to Iowa. I understand that a lot of you, or most of you, are not from Iowa, maybe the first time being in Iowa. But I want to then, more than anything, is welcome you to the University of Iowa and welcome you to Hancher. And as you might guess, 45 years of presenting the world's finest artists, we have a rich, rich history. And thanks to special collections at University of Iowa Libraries, and thanks to Greg and to David, we have preserved that history and preserved it in the right way. That history includes artists such as Rudolf Nureyev, Ella Fitzgerald, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Isaac Stern, Beverly Stills, Van Cliburn, Marcel Marceau, Pavarotti, Dizzy Gillespie, and I can't forget Gregory Peck. And that's just a handful. And I've got to tell you that we all together, telling these stories, we at Hancher know how important the work that all of you do is, and we applaud you, and we appreciate that great work. And let's continue to tell those great stories, because together we can make this world a better place. So really, enjoy your time here at Iowa, enjoy your night tonight at Hancher, and thank you very much.
And thank you, Chuck, for welcoming us here. So as a final reminder, just to let you know that our section chair, John Overholt, will be coming up after the Q&A for this session to give a few announcements. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our moderator for this session, Agnieszka Czablakoff. Agnieszka Czablakoff is the Rare Books Librarian at the University of Texas at San Antonio. She also holds a PhD in Latin American History from Emory University. Her dissertation, A Prison by Any Other Name, Incarceration in the 17th and 18th Century, Audiencia de Quito, is a history of colonial punishment and incarceration focused on confinement systems and practices in colonial Ecuador. And I will now pass our plenary off to Agnieszka's capable hands.
Thank you, Julie. That was a very nice introduction, and you did a great job on my name. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for our second plenary session titled Representation. For the past 2 days, we have been sharing stories and listening to stories about our collections, our institutions, our work and projects, and ourselves as we attend workshops and seminars. Tweet and Instagram about things seen and heard, hashtag RBMS17, and mingle with colleagues new and old over a glass of a refreshing beverage. Iowa City has been buzzing with the voices and stories. The storytelling has affirmed our sense of belonging in an imagined community of cultural heritage workers committed to collecting and preserving a more complete and inclusive historical record, replete with stories, artifacts, documents, and representations of lived experiences of the communities around us. But that's only part of the story. Our repositories and institutions have been filling with historical records as we painstakingly invite every other in, to quote Vern Harris, into the archival mainstream. But amid this documentary abundance, there still looms a sense of absence and silence produced by our institutional practices of selecting, appraising, arranging, and describing our access policies and our own individual subjectivities. We notice distortions and omissions in our collections, catalog records, or exhibit labels brought on by our own limited knowledge, experience, and fragmentary or decontextualized documentary record. Those silences and fragments can and will tell us a story if we dare to ask. I am joined today by Janet Weaver and Dr. Angela Aguayo, who in their archival and scholarly and documentary practice have been daring to ask and challenging the incomplete, missing, or fragmentary historical narratives within and without the special collections and archives institutions. In their work with underrepresented and marginalized communities in rural Iowa and southern Illinois, they have grappled with the complex strategies to more accurately and mindfully represent the historical and cultural perspectives embedded in the living oral traditions in their local communities that have been absent from dominant narratives or are at risk of being lost forever. At the heart of our speakers' presentations is one of the oldest types of historical inquiry, one that predates the written word. and also one that is the most modern, introduced with tape recorders in the 1940s and now using digital technologies. I'm talking about storytelling, or more formally known among historians as oral history. In this plenary, we'll hear about how critical, inclusive, and sustained engagement with oral history can be a catalyst to building partnerships that bring voices of marginalized communities to the archives, preserving stories on the verge of being lost, and creating new media formats like documentary filmmaking that have the potential of inspiring and supporting community movements for social justice. Today, our speakers will discuss the practices and methods gleaned from traditional oral history and documentary filmmaking that consider critical questions and urge deep reflexivity about any project that aims to represent or speak for the other. They will gently nudge us to explore strange new worlds of creating dynamic and inclusive collaborations and participatory spaces, to boldly go where a few have gone before by disrupting our authority and leveraging the community expertise, and acknowledging that the silent speakers' motives, wills, perspectives, and ways of doing things may be radically different from our own. Our first speaker today, Janet Weaver, is the assistant curator of the Iowa Women's Archives at the University of Iowa Libraries. She's a PhD candidate in history at UI, researching U.S. labor history to a case study of Iowa button workers during the Progressive Era. In her presentation, she approaches the field of oral history as a fundamentally archival practice that records and preserves new knowledge about the past for future use. Since the 1970s, Janet has been involved in oral history projects to preserve the history of those who are underrepresented in traditional archives and whose contributions have been marginalized by dominant historical narratives. At the Iowa Women's Archives, she works not only to expand primary sources relating to Latinas, their families, and organizations, but also to bring this history to light. For Janet, the institutional archive becomes a catalyst for the undocumented and the marginalized participants and communities to contribute missing perspective and historical documentation. It is also a platform of shared authority for the inception of the project to its final product. She's the author of two articles on Mexican-American activism in Eastern Iowa and recently coordinated the development of Migration is Beautiful, a digital humanities project to bring Iowa Latina history into a larger audience. Our second plenary speaker, Dr. Angela Aguayo, is an associate professor of cinema and digital culture at Southern Illinois University Carbondale. And she asks us to consider not only the gaping voids and silences in the historical records and narratives, but to push the interdisciplinary oral history projects beyond the archival purposes of recovery, historical knowledge creation, and preservation, and into the realm of active community engagements, participatory archiving, and tangible public deliverables like films, community screenings, forums, websites, and apps, and most importantly, I think, a dialogue and a transformative social change on the local level. As an artist and scholar whose work creates connections between critical production practice, social change documentary, theory, and history, Angela has built an interdisciplinary community engagement research agenda, exemplified by creation of programs like Girls Make Movies and the Rural Civil Rights Project. She's the author of a number of scholarly essays and is currently writing her second book, Documentary and Social Change, an Investigation of Participatory Media Cultures. Angela is also an award-winning director and producer of 5 documentary shorts, utilized in community engagement campaigns, exhibited museums, and viewed at dozens of film festivals around the world. She's currently working on her first feature-length documentary, The Ritual. Please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Try to pull up my PowerPoint. There we go. Oops. Let's start here. Thank you, Agnieszka, for the wonderful introduction. I wonder really if I need to give this presentation because she summarized everything so well. And I'd also like to thank the chairs of this conference for inviting me to participate in this panel. I think if I had known when I agreed to do it, it was a great honor, but if I'd known it was going to be in Hampshire, I might have thought twice about it because it's really a little overwhelming, although beautiful. Yes, I'm an archivist and historian, professions dedicated on the one hand to creating finding aids that provide access to collections. On the other, to writing historical narratives that are often and justifiably criticized as being mind-numbingly dull, one damn fact after another. And we love all of those facts. We are not storytellers by nature, and yet we should and we must embrace the art of storytelling in order to bring the public into the archives, to share authority. It is not enough to say the archives is open to the public. We must give people a reason to want to visit and partner with us. I think we can do this best by creating space for others to tell us their stories and inviting them to collaborate with us in shaping projects and events. Last spring, Michaela Toronas, a young Latina from Davenport, attended an event in the Iowa Women's Archives called Mujeres Latinas, Every Woman Has a Story. The archives invited donors of collections and members of the public to bring mementos from their past to share and discuss with participants, and also to look at the materials about the rich history of Iowa Latinas preserved in the Iowa Women's Archives. Here, Michaela is holding up a photograph of her great-great-grandfather. She's telling the story of how her family came to Iowa from Mexico over 100 years ago and lived in a Mexican barrio called Cook's Point on the banks of the Mississippi River in Davenport. Her family's story has been passed down through generations and is part of the much larger Latino community history preserved in the Iowa Women's Archives. And this fall, we're excited that Michaela will be an incoming student in the School of Library and Information Science here, and she will also hold the position, the highly competitive and sought-after position, of the Olson Graduate Assistant for the next 2 years, working in Special Collections and the Iowa Women's Archives. Michaela will be part of the ongoing project here to increase awareness of Latino history in Iowa. Her family's history is connected to that of Martina Morado. On the eve of the Mexican Revolution, Martina Morado and her mother left their home in the state of Guanajuato, Mexico. They made the long journey north to Horton, Kansas. The year was 1910, and Martina was 13 years old. In Horton, they joined relatives in a community of workers who worked for the Rock Island Railroad. Martina's mother, a skilled seamstress, as you can tell by the clothes she's wearing in this photograph, took in laundry and cooked meals for railroad section workers to provide for herself and her daughter. More than 40 years later, she would write her life story, La Obra de una Mamá, The Labor of a Mother. She told of her marriage to Julio Vallejo and their 11 children. She told how her husband, like many railroad workers, was forced out of his job during the Great Depression, a period when many Mexicans were forcibly repatriated. Martina recalled that they had to move north and work in the sugar beet fields of Minnesota. She described the terrible 12-hour journey north by truck, soaked by rain under a leaky tarp, and I believe she was pregnant with her 11th child. In the 1940s, her husband once again found steady employment on the railroad, and the Vallejo family, as they then pronounced their name, settled permanently in Des Moines, Iowa, which is where this photograph of the 7 Vallejo sisters was taken in 1945. We know about Martina Morado because she wrote her story down, and because her daughter, Florence Taronis, generously donated her papers to the Iowa Women's Archives. In 2012, three generations of Martina Marado's descendants stood beneath a 5-foot banner of her portrait at the exhibition Pathways to Iowa, Migration Stories from the Iowa Women's Archives. The donor of the collection, Florence Taronis, is standing in the center. Her daughter on the left, and her granddaughter on the right, then a freshman at the University of Iowa. Martina Marotta's life story is more than just her narrative. It is representative of the narrative of so many women who were first-generation Mexican immigrants. We have come a long way from the days when archival collections were only about prominent white men and their military and political history. Now women's voices are no longer hidden whispers in the crevices of archival repositories. The documents entrusted by women to archivists for preservation now and into the future resound in conversation with each other. This creates a richer narrative that helps us see the past in new ways and enables new stories to be told. It is richer not only because we have worked hard to bring women's voices to the archive, but also because we are not content to bring in only the voices of elite white women. And yet, most of these voices still are white women's voices, and they are all often the voices of the elite. In his presidential address to the American Historical Association in 2013, William Cronin asserted, "More than anything else, we need to keep telling stories about why the past matters and why all of us should care about it. Nothing is more important, for only by the never-ending telling of such stories is the dead past reborn into memory to become living history over and over and over again." Cronin's point is a powerful one, but whose stories are we telling? What is the role of special collections and archivists in gathering and preserving historical documentation of underrepresented or marginalized communities? How can we work towards this goal, and why should we prioritize it? These questions get to the heart of something we deal with every day, the tension between power and memory. Representation and historical narratives matter because they alter and enrich our understanding of the past. They matter because they provide opportunities for students and visitors to the archives to see themselves in our collections, to make connections and draw inspiration from those who have gone before. It is empowering to situate oneself in historical narratives. Today, when students visit the Iowa Women's Archives for their classes, they might find their family history there, or they might make connections to a larger pattern of Latino migration to the Midwest. At its core, history is a conversation between generations about memory, place, and shared human connections, rather than a linear story of progress. History is experiential. We grow up with it, we consume it, we become comfortable with it. But the role of dominant narratives in shaping public consciousness is contested, and it should be. For example, the Ken Burns documentary on Jefferson denied Jefferson's liaison with Sally Hemings. But when scientific evidence confirmed that Jefferson was indeed the father of the Hemings line, Monticello completely revised its narrative at the historic site to make Sally Hemings and slavery a central part of the story there. As archivists, we have opportunities to work in seemingly small ways to develop and preserve perspectives that have been underrepresented in our collections. Although the world of special collections is still overwhelmingly white, many of us are deeply committed to making sure our collection development priorities and strategies are diverse, and we can play an important role in building and providing access to resources that shape new historical narratives and become part of the process of challenging and deconstructing the old. One example of a woman of color finding a place in the historical narrative through material being preserved in the Iowa Women's Archives is the story of Dolores Garcia, whose photograph is on the front page of this 1970 issue of Ain't I a Woman. Ain't I a Woman is a local press that was published in the early 70s, and there are several issues of it in the exhibit in the gallery in the main library, so you can go there and take a look at some of them. Ain't I a Woman was a Midwest newspaper of women's liberation, which had a national circulation. It was published by the Women's Liberation Front in Iowa City. In 1970, Iowa City feminists went to Davenport to report on a protest outside the Oscar Mayer Packing House, and they interviewed Dolores Garcia, seen here on the front page of the paper. She was calling for a boycott of Oscar Mayer products because of the company's discriminatory hiring practices. The Iowa City feminists covered the story under the headline, "Not Everybody Loves an Oscar Mayer Wiener." The signs of the Mexican-American and African-American protesters proclaimed, "Boycott Oscar Mayer, Brown is Beautiful," and 1970, Year of the Chicano. In this article, Garcia described her frustration and with the difficulty of Mexican-Americans in finding entry to better-paying blue-collar jobs. She saw the issue in terms of race and gender-based discrimination. An oral history interview recorded with Dolores Garcia for the IWA in 2005 illuminates the newspaper article, which was previously a hidden whisper from the archives. A second-generation Mexican-American, Garcia was born and raised in Cook's Point on the Mississippi River in Davenport. In 1969, she had learned the power of public protest through her experience picketing local supermarkets to support Cesar Chavez and the boycott of California table grapes. "That's what I learned from it," she explained in her interview. "You have the same right as anybody else. Fight for it. If you don't get it, you can pick it until you do." Dolores Garcia's story helps us situate Latinas firmly at the vanguard of the women's movement in the 1970s. Adding her story to the historical narrative becomes part of reframing and enriching our understanding of second-wave feminism. Oral history is an important tool for bringing the voices of Latinas, African-Americans, and workers into archives, where manuscript collections reflecting their firsthand experiences are scarce. In the 1970s, Iowa union members started a long-term project to preserve the stories of Iowa workers because they wanted to shape a new and more inclusive narrative of the past. The leaders of the Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, responded to the tension between power and memory when they decided to start their own labor history project. It was known as the Iowa Labor History Oral Project, ILHOP. The idea for this project started outside the academy in the early 1970s when progressive IFL leaders realized the importance of documenting and preserving the rich history of Iowa workers. Leading the initiative were James Wingert, a former Sioux City Packing House worker and state legislator, and Mark Smith, a former high school teacher and labor educator. They saw that workers' experiences had great educational and historical value, recognizing that workers rarely had the opportunity to write down their stories. Wingert and Smith sought a way to make sure they were not forgotten. The project was a collaboration with the University of Iowa Labor Center and the State Historical Society of Iowa, which served as the repository for the interviews. Between 1977 and 1997, this large-scale historic preservation effort, costing $500,000, collected 1,100 interviews, documenting the memories of workers and union members across the state and stretching back as far as the 1890s. Today, these interviews are the foundation of the Iowa Labor Collection, a nationally significant research archive held by the State Historical Society. Implicit in the determination of Iowa labor leaders to fund the preservation of their history was an understanding that the production and consumption of history is a contested terrain. Because of the progressive vision of the IFL and its members, the Iowa Labor Collection has enabled the telling of a rich and complex history of work and community in Iowa from the perspective of Iowa working people. Robert Jackson Sr.'s interview exemplifies the richness and range of the ILHOP interviews. It encompasses daily life and issues of race, class, gender, and ethnicity. Jackson was born in Lexington, Missouri in 1917 and died in Des Moines last year at the age of 99. Jackson's father was a coal miner, his mother a housewife, and his ancestors had been slaves in Missouri. When he moved to Des Moines in the 1930s, he was struck by the extreme segregation he confronted there. He recalled, "Regardless of what they say about Missouri, at that time it was more integrated than Iowa was, especially Des Moines. Where I come from, the only thing that I knew was two types of work, the coal mines and working in the stores around there. And that employment was readily available to any of us, black, white, Italian, or whatever. When I got here, the only type of job that was open was the maid in the hotel, or the janitor, or cleaning up one of the theaters. So the job description discrimination was quite a bit more here than it was in the town in Missouri where I was from." In the 1940s, after the war, Jackson took part in a sit-in at the Katz drugstore in Des Moines. And he recalled, "During the war, people had been out in the ordnance plant, and they'd been making good money. They managed to save some. They worked into some good jobs. So the first thing they wanted to do when they were working downtown was sit down and eat. And they wouldn't let you eat in the lunch counters." Yes, right here, Katz drugstore was the first one we tackled after the war. We had a sit-in, and a lady called Edna Griffin started that at Katz. Edna Griffin was later known as the Rosa Parks of Iowa. She called the sit-in at the Katz drugstore because, like Jackson, she was appalled at the level of segregation she found in Des Moines. She had originally come here from New York. And Griffin's papers and oral history, as well as her FBI file, are preserved in the Iowa Women's Archives. The Iowa Labor History Oral Project continues today with an Archie Green Fellowship from the American Folklife Center, funding a new round of interviews with recent immigrants and refugees. An exhibit about the history of IHOP is currently touring the state in the UI Mobile Museum, and last year, IHOP founded the Iowa Labor History Society. This year, the UI Libraries joins the State Historical Society and IHOP in a collaborative partnership. A recent grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission will digitize the 1,100 analog interviews through a collaboration between the State Historical Society, the Iowa Federation of Labor, the UI Labor Center, and the UI Libraries. Like the founders of the Iowa Labor History Project, the founders of the Iowa Women's Archives understood that history was contested when they determined to go forward with a plan to establish an archive dedicated to collecting and preserving the history of Iowa women. In 1990, when Louise Nowne and Mary Louise Smith met with UI President Hunter Rawlings, he readily agreed to provide space for the women's archives. When he raised the question of funding, Louise Nowne decided to auction the one painting in her collection that might generate the substantial sum necessary to create an endowment for the archives. As a result, Frida Kahlo's self-portrait with loose hair sold at auction at Christie's in 1991 for $1.65 million, and the Louise Nowne Mary Louise Smith Iowa Women's Archives opened its doors in 1992. Karen Mason joined the archives that year as its first curator. And this year is the 25th anniversary of the archives. So I know Karen's out there somewhere. Let me just acknowledge Karen Mason. Throughout its existence, Mason has consistently asked, what stories are missing? How can we nurture projects to develop collections from groups underrepresented in archives? With help from outside funding and financial donors, the Iowa Women's Archives has supported major projects to preserve the history of African-American women, farm women, Jewish women, and Latinas. In 2002, at IWA's 10th anniversary symposium, Rusty Barcelo, who had previously served as assistant provost here, challenged the archives to move forward with its plan to preserve Iowa Latina history. IWA obtained grant funding to establish the Mujeres Latinas Project. And between 2005 and 2007, four Latina interviewers worked on the project with IWA staff recording interviews in communities across Iowa. Together, these six interviewers recorded over 100 oral histories. Each brought important insights to her work. For example, Teresa Garcia, then a PhD candidate in the College of Education, pursued questions of education that built on her knowledge in that area, while librarian Rachel Garza Carrion brought an understanding of Mexican-American culture. These interviews provide a new framework that broadens our interpretation of Iowa history, situating Mexicans among the immigrants who settled Iowa in the early 20th century. Although project funding ended in 2007, the IWA continued to build collections and maintain communications with project participants. From the start of the Mujeres Latinas Project, the Iowa League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC, has worked closely with the IWA. For those of you who don't know LULAC, LULAC is a national civil rights organization that started in the Southwest in 1929 and moved into the Midwest in the 1950s. Iowa LULAC members introduced us to people to interview. They donated their records and personal papers to IWA, and many families became regular visitors to the archives. And we're fortunate to have at least one representative from LULAC with us today, so I'd like to acknowledge Iowa State LULAC Director Michael Reyes, who's somewhere out there. The decision to develop a website to bring the history and stories of Iowa Latinas to a larger public audience was inspired by the growing interest in the Latino Midwest on the part of educators, researchers, and the public. Planning the Migration is Beautiful Digital Humanities Project was undertaken by the IWA in collaboration with the Digital Scholarship and Publishing Studio at the University of Iowa Libraries. The idea for calling the website Migration is Beautiful evolved out of IWA's close collaboration with the Davenport LULAC Council. LULAC members were instrumental in our decision to use, with her permission, acclaimed feminist artist Fabiana Rodriguez's poster of the monarch butterfly with Latina faces in its wings as the logo for the website. The decision to call the website Migration is Beautiful resonated with the early members of LULAC because, as they explained during a visit, they explained to us during a visit to IWA, like the monarch butterfly, many of their ancestors had originally come from the central plateau of Mexico, and like the butterfly, their migration had been circular and multi-generational. In 2015, National LULAC President Roger Rocha visited the archives to see the Mujeres Latinas collections. He invited archive staff to bring an exhibit of Iowa Latina history to the National Convention in Washington, D.C. the following summer. And so the photograph on the right there, or on the left there, is that physical pop-up exhibit that was created and Iowa LULAC members standing in front of it. Technology and digital platforms have the capacity to reach broad audiences and shape new narratives. And while these new digital initiatives expand our reach beyond anything we could even have begun to imagine, and definitely beyond academic institutions, old-fashioned methods of communication must remain at the heart of what we do. Many of the non-traditional communities that we seek to represent do not have regular access to internet, and nothing replaces being able to touch and feel original documents. As Robert Archibald put it, real community building is not about how museums reach out, it's about how we allow the community to reach into our institutions. The Iowa Labor History Project and Mujeres Latinas projects show that when communities reach into special collections departments and tell us what they want, we can collaborate in building, preserving, and making collections accessible and visible. Our ability to reach into the past and learn from it is richer when we work together and share authority with communities. Only by working together can the Whispers from archives become forceful voices in repositories across the country, providing access to local stories on which to ground a new master narrative of history. These voices speak to us compellingly, loudly proclaiming how much we do not yet know about our past. And I'll just close with a reflection written by a student who created a video as part of a Spanish and Portuguese course assignment. And that student wrote, "My entire video was inspired through the visit to the Iowa Wounds Archive. It was exciting to use the people that mean the most to me and see how they view themselves in this world, more specifically, how they view their life in relation to the United States through many generations. The Women's Archive helped me realize how important it was to share stories about migrating to the United States and, more importantly, the Midwest. Thank you."
Good afternoon. I've had a handful of speaking invitations over the years, and nothing has made me feel more honored than to receive the invitation to be here today. I have a confession. If I could bottle up all of the strange, wild, specialized knowledge that you keep in your collective heads, I would live in that bubble forever. I have a tendency to think of rare book and manuscript specialists as protectors of the objects that we hold most important to our world. At times, I think of your work in somewhat epic terms, specialist, Indiana Jones and Laura Croft-like characters, challenging, fighting to protect the residue materials of our rich cultural life against challenges in time and dwindling resources for the good of our collective survival. For the sake of fun, I hope a few of you get to wield swords while doing this. If this expectation feels heavy, I apologize, but we are living in a time that is uncertain about its own facts, and archives are where facts become institutionalized. There is an incredible social power in what you do, worthy of deep consideration. I want to thank the Rare Book and Manuscript section for inviting me to talk with you about representation in the archive. These themes, stories, archives, and representation, resonate deeply with my work as a scholar and a documentary filmmaker. As a scholar, I seek to understand how documentary moving image functions in the process of social change. As a filmmaker, I strive to make documentary media that features untold stories and alternative histories. I find myself struggling with representation on a daily basis when I record, research, collect materials for storytelling. Representation is the act of depicting, symbolizing, or describing one part that ends up standing in for the whole. It's a translation and a meaning-making process that happens in most things that we do, including how we tell stories about institutions and our own history. Representation can refer to an encoding and decoding process in storytelling, how we package characters, storylines, performances, to highlight some attributes at the cost of others. Our selection process in dealing with archives, assigning relative importance to some documents rather than others, featuring certain materials and shelving others, these are all decisions that require choices about representation. The process of representation is incredibly compelling and problematic. For representations to be widely accepted in an archive or a film, this requires cultural inclusion, approval, and familiarity. As communication scholar Walter Fisher suggests, stories need narrative coherence and fidelity. The representations in the story should be consistent and familiar enough to be credible. This runs deep for all of us. But how often are we reflexive about this process? Today I'm going to slip between theory, history, and my own experience to talk about the complexities of the archive and representation. And I say complexities because I can't offer many answers, but I do have some questions and educated instincts on ways we might be able to navigate through these troubling waters. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about resisting where you exist. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about seeking out inclusive collaborations. And finally, some problems engaging and speaking for others. Growing up as a first-generation Chicanos in Los Angeles, my brother and I would sometimes sit around the breakfast table with my father after his night shift, and we would talk about history. At the same time we began learning about California history in grade school, my father started taking classes at East Los Angeles College. As a Mexican immigrant, my father was particularly inspired when we started learning about California history. The breakfast table became this place to unpack and deconstruct social studies lessons. "Did you know California was stolen from Mexico?" my dad asked one morning. It was the first time in the moment I remember questioning authority, textbooks, teachers, myths, school lessons, politicians, and the government. What I could not quite articulate at the time is the sticky and complicated way the duality of history functions and the hegemonic precision of certain stories taking more precedence and legitimacy over others. At a tender age, I had learned there was capital H history that was official and institutionalized and sanctioned and documented and often disconnected from my life. There was also the people's history, undocumented, oral, renegade in its impulse to speak truth to power, handed down, and unsanctioned. These stories felt more connected to my life and the people who came before me. These are the stories that are often left on the cutting room floor of history. Much of my experience struggling with the archive comes from my work documenting stories on the verge of being lost. Working in oral history and community document collection is an exercise in tussling with the archive, its bounty and its absence, searching in basements, closets, personal storage lockers, and finding myself with more digital files than I can process. When I'm beginning a project, I generally get in the habit of asking a series of questions. What stories currently exist in the archive, in the record, in the collection? And whose interests do those materials serve? Which stories are missing? What can be added to the historical record? What is significant about these stories? And finally, how can I collaborate with others to make the record more complete, dynamic, multivocal, and inclusive? The more voices we bring to bear within the archive, even in their inconsistent logics and memory, the closer we get to understanding the root lessons of history. If we don't occasionally start from what could be missing from the record, working with less worn paths, picking up clues that might lead us somewhere different and uncertain, we risk reinforcing the power structures that currently guide our thinking. Some less worn paths are easier to travel than others. My current institution has a long and impressive record of serving underrepresented students. Upon arriving at my faculty orientation, they proudly displayed a picture of the first graduating class, which includes African-American students. This picture was curious to me. It did not square with what I knew of the region or the local area. Carbondale is situated in southern Illinois, a bit of a crossroads in race relations, stretching back to migration of slaves from the south to the north. When the passenger trains headed south, Carbondale is where they attached the colored car to maintain a segregated southern transportation system. It is a town deeply impacted by the migrations of slavery and a silent, almost forgotten civil rights history. The town is still visibly segregated by race. The black community exists under similar pressures experienced by another town up the road, Ferguson, Missouri. Most Carbondale residents during the late 1960s and a generation removed are not aware that a presence of a Black Panther chapter existed in Carbondale or the police shootout that took place in November 1970. We all have these moments. Something doesn't square with what you know. There's something out of place. More perspectives exist that the topic that could bear understanding on the topic and establish a new understanding of our grand narrative theory of history. What I learned after my faculty orientation is that Carbondale has a rich and significant civil rights history that was only marginally documented, if at all. It's a living and an oral tradition that has a handful of active community historians and closets full of documents. This moment gave way to the Rural Civil Rights Project, an interdisciplinary humanities project focused on using digital production practice as a means to community engagement. The aim is to uncover an undocumented history in the form of recorded oral histories, the preservation of primary documents, identifying important landmarks, and generating feedback from the community that lived through these experiences. It's kind of a grassroots metadata process. The conditions afforded by the digital production process are then used to engage in the reconstruction of local history with the hopes of beginning a more productive community dialogue. For me, this impulse starts from a lifetime about thinking about representation and rarely finding myself or my community in the archives of official capital H history. For others, it comes from seeing the patterns of representation that produce partial history and embracing those responsibility to do something about it. Resist where you exist, someone wise once told me, by asking questions about what is missing and in whose interest particular stories circulate. What investigators of all types often assume is that grassroots people's history is sitting there waiting to be documented. History that is excluded from official, public, and institutionalized documents comes with a unique set of circumstances that provide opportunities and challenges for rethinking historical memory. The question of in whose interest a story is being constructed must take precedence. This is a heavy obligation, one that I don't take lightly, and I don't always get it right. There's a history of researchers acting in ways that are often uncritical, willing to sacrifice social justice and systematic analysis in exchange for recording stories for quick professional gain, or to focus on disaster narratives as the history from the margins, or privileging objects over lived experience. Researchers of all varieties frequently embark upon marginalized communities for study, collect data, and disappear. This has led to what Gubner and Harper identify as research fatigue, or a feeling of the general distrust by subjects of academic research. It is delicate terrain that must be carefully navigated. And as documentary filmmaker Jean Rouch is often attributed to saying, telling stories is a form of shared anthropology. I had heard of the Black Panther chapter that exists in Carbondale, but paper documentation was scarce. Some crafty searches in the basements of our county courthouse produced documentation of a Black Panther chapter, a multi-hour gunfight, and a trial. Gathering the initial interviews to elaborate upon the primary historical research was difficult, for good reason. There's often a concern about the motives of recording oral memory. This kind of trust runs deep within Carbondale. For people who experienced the shootout in November 1970, it was deeply traumatic. Hundreds, possibly thousands of bullets were fired into a sleeping neighborhood while children were in striking distance. We sought out Margaret Nesbitt, who lived two stores down from the shootout, for guidance and information. She insisted that the production team attend city council meetings and other community events before she agreed, 1 year later, to grant us an interview about the perspective on the shooting, on one condition. Ms. Nesbitt was not interested in talking about history as a way of looking back, but an opportunity to move forward. Trust was gained by routinely returning to participants' homes to share edits on laptops, digitize materials, and project findings in community centers. These conditions provided the opportunity to brainstorm with community members about new collaborative frameworks for understanding local history. During a hot July evening In the summer of 2013, I found myself in a church basement where many groups have met in Carbondale during the civil rights struggle of the 1960s. There was a community screening of the first documentary from the Rural Civil Rights Project called 778 Bullets, chronicling the little-known shootout between law enforcement and Carbondale Black Panthers. I don't have time to play the 20-minute documentary for you, but if you're interested in knowing more, you can stream it online, you can Google it. The dominant memory of the Black Panther Party would have people believe that the organization was mostly constructed around violence and existed only in urban cities. 778 Bullets documents a more rural presence of radical politics, extending our understanding of the Black Panthers in places as unlikely as rural Illinois. It also provides a counter memory of the organization, which was committed to public service and willing to engage in peaceful resolution to violent police action. But on a hot July evening, days after the non-guilty verdict of George Zimmerman shooting Trayvon Martin, a deeply profound, rare public discussion about race emerged in this small community after the screening of 778 Bullets. The actual act of violence on the screen stood in for a host of invisible and notable infractions concerning race and local history. Collectively, the audience began to piece together information about the shootout with live oral testimony, connecting how these stories might be related to other acts of aggressive police violence in Carbondale and across the nation. There was a spontaneous call to action, and from this moment forward, the Rural Civil Rights, the Racial Justice Coalition was born. An activist group that solidifies around the documentary screen, but continues to organize and agitate on behalf of an inclusive and equitable community. Participatory archiving and community engagement can play an important role in bridging the difference between the negotiation of a more inclusive public memory. Taking a page from Ms. Nesbitt, can the archives that we work with every day help contribute to better understandings of the most important social problems of our day? I didn't like this question when it came my way. It was uncomfortable and made me question my process, prodded me to rethink my assumptions, but it also helped me travel down a few roads that resulted in deeply meaningful work. As we're asking productive questions and thinking about collaboration, let's talk about how we tread through these waters with care. For most of cinema history, the media makers fortunate enough to learn the craft and acquire the equipment to produce visual media have historically come from the privileged class. Filmmakers can gain access or exposure to grassroots stories easily, but under tenuous conditions and from outsider perspectives. Robert Flaherty, one of the forefathers of documentary, is widely cited as recording some of the first moving images of Inuit people, but he also asked his main character, Nanook, to use more primitive hunting tools to fit the clash of the civilizations experience Flaherty was interested in depicting. Ultimately, Nanook and his family were represented as primitive beings living on an ice shelf in a land far, far away. In reality, Nanook hunted with a gun and was an entrepreneurial tradesman. As social theorist Guattari Spivak suggests, when considering how one does research beyond their own internal subject position, critical attention must be paid to the relationship between the researcher and the individuals being examined, especially when representations are produced. Yang and Tucker echo Spivak's concern, stating that one major colonial task of social scientific research has been to pose as a voice box, ventriloquist interpreter of the underrepresented. Many problematic representations stem from the lack of reflexivity about historical hierarchies of power in society that may map onto various forms of representational authorship. Collecting underrepresented stories requires trust and shared motives. These kinds of connections are not easily forged, especially when a creative team does not have an organic connection to the community. Yet filmmakers, researchers, or any of us can't abdicate the responsibility to document the most important issues of our day, even if we don't belong to a particular community. It's a delicious bind. of learning something new, establishing collaborations, and having to be ever vigilant about the representations that emerge under these conditions. Filmmakers like George Stoney pioneered ways to root around these problems by partnering with communities to create shared representations. From invention to exhibition, space was created to bring as many different voices to the table as possible. This process is as arduous and daunting as it sounds, and it's a commitment to process for a more inclusive output. Filmmakers in the 1970s, especially women and people of color, would turn the camera in on themselves, adding to the tapestry of representations that would, but on their own terms. This was a revolutionary moment, producing new ways to tell stories. It went beyond visibility politics and it introduced new points of view to cinema history. In the summer of 2013, a local school district invited me to develop a media empowerment summer camp for at-risk middle school boys, where students learned about oral history of civil rights and recorded it from their perspective. The clip I'm about to show you is a big deal for these young men. They were uncomfortable about presenting themselves formally and requesting an interview with someone they don't know, especially asking questions about race. So the following clip is a moment when the boys talk to Raheem, the owner of the only store that sells black beauty supplies for miles.
Yes, understanding who you are and where you're from. And why is that so important?
We are
about your history of life. And then by doing that, what did that, how does it help you in your life as a productive human being? By knowing your history and knowing who you are.
It's actually really good to be as a way. If you didn't know your history, you wouldn't know who you were exactly.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't know who you were. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what racism has done for me. You know, it's one group saying that they're more superior than another group. Or another group inferior than another group. And how some groups have taken advantage of other groups. Of course. So now it helps me to know about me. Education begins with oneself first, and then we start taking on other things, then science. You know, we had great men and women that was in science, that was inventing things, you know, like the stoplight.
communities face, excuse me, when communities face long-standing contained agency, the tools of digital production can enable a necessary response. Science required an expression of testimony at this historical moment, and the digital tools facilitated an environment of intimate testimony. Representation is essential and necessary, but from whose perspective representation emerge must be a question on the table for exploration. We are living in a historical moment where our world is deeply divided, shifting and revealing insights about what had been structurally and systematically eliminated from the official record. I want to challenge you to take the call of being reflexive about how we process representation and how in our works and our life and our work. I encourage you to embrace representation as resistance by asking what is missing, by seeking out productive collaborations, and by questioning authorship and the possibilities of perspective on the impact of storytelling. Reflexivity takes time and conscious choice. It doesn't happen on its own. We must choose to be critical, reflexive, and desire to understand the role, however small, each of us play in the everyday process and choices in representing ourselves and other people. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet and Angela. This was wonderful. We are now open for questions. There are two microphones in the aisles, so feel free to come up if you have questions for our speakers. And I will begin with first question, and then we'll see what happens. So my question is for both of you, kind of reflecting on the urge to be reflexive. How has working with the communities and collecting oral histories the way Janet does, and then you working with the communities to film themselves and film them, how has that changed you as a scholar, as an archivist, as a filmmaker?
Well, let me speak. Working with the community, I found that initially I just wondered who we might interview. And my part of the Mujeres Latinas project was to work in the Quad Cities area, the Davenport, Bettendorf area in the eastern Iowa. And so once I contacted someone who had, the first thing they did was they invited me into a meeting of a reunion of individuals. And I went there, and it was at the LULAC Center in Davenport, and it was called the Cook's Point Reunion, and that's where I met a lot of people. And once that was done, we were given many names, and I think it was through LULAC that they opened the doors of people they made people trust us as people who they could entrust their stories to. And so once the initial thrust of the interviewing period was over, I decided to stay in touch with the community. And initially it was a scholarly interest, doing research in newspaper microfilm, drawing me much more deeply into the narrative in a way that I never anticipated, stories of a civil rights movement that was largely undocumented. My connection, I kept going back because there were things I didn't understand from their interviews that led me to do that research, and I developed strong relationships with the people I had interviewed, and eventually I was asked to go to a fiesta and surprised by being made an honorary member of LULAC Council 10. And so at that point I decided, well, that's a great honor, and so I'm going to go to the meetings. And so I started going to the LULAC meetings on Sunday afternoons. And that's how the project kept going, because then I felt very honored to become, in a way, part of their community, and the project became richer And that's really why I think I felt like it needed to become more visible, that it was still hidden in the archives. People weren't coming to do research, that they were very willing to put their materials online. And I thought, if the primary documents can go online, then people can read them themselves and draw their own conclusions. So that's sort of where it took me. That was a little bit of a long answer.
I like the question you asked, like, how does it change you? Because I really feel like this work has changed me. Like, I was much more self-focused about how I did my work before the last 10 years, where I would think, oh, what do I want to do because I'm interested in it? I actually flip the script now. I say, what are the most pressing problems in my community and how can I contribute? That isn't something we're taught to do. And so I ask myself that and I challenge myself to think about my work in those ways. I also think about being conscientious and flexible about the way people arrive at the idea of documentation and archiving, that the first people I approached about doing this work were completely resistant. And until they could put their eyes on me in the community and see me, and that I wasn't going to extract myself, or that I wasn't focused on my own personal interests, that's when the community opened up to me. And I actually got access to the community by backgrounding my own professional interests.
Excellent, thank you. We have a question coming up.
Hi, I'm Margaret Nichols from Cornell University. And first of all, I just wanted to say I really admire the work that both of you are doing. And thank you so much for describing it and sharing it with us. I just wondered, do you ever encounter resistance within the academic community from people who feel that by engaging in social justice work and by trying to bring out the voices of people who haven't been heard, that you're surrendering your objectivity in some way, and that, you know, you really should distance yourself and that kind of thing? And if you do hear that kind of thing from people, how do you respond to that?
Yes, I encounter those folks. They are here. I'm sure many of them are, maybe some of them are in this room. And it's a position, right? It's a position to take on research. And I encountered it mostly in graduate school, where I was kind of more in a position where people were trying to shape who I was going to be. I've encountered it less once I've kind of established my professional life as a professor. What I told those professors in graduate school was that it is my connection to the community that precisely makes the work be more productive, and that that there is something really powerful when knowledge production can be tied to community problems, right? Even and that's like that's like common sense, right? That, you know, what we study and what we do should actually connect up with people in their lives. And so I make the case on those grounds and talk about instances in which the work was helped by having alignment with interests with the people in the community. That could be a critique of my work, but I'm willing to kind of argue with that on that level and kind of move forward. As the academy continues to hop and struggle along, and as it implodes and changes and grows, I really do believe that connection about knowledge production and community engagement is going to be at the center of what might be coming next. So I say let's all get on board.
I agree with that. And I think actually we're sort of on different sides of the spectrum, because Angela's in the academy and I'm in archives and librarianship. And so archivists and librarians are sort of stealthy individuals, and we tend to work quietly and behind the scenes. And I think librarians as a whole are very engaged in social justice and supportive of those ideas. However, the boundaries that I found were, well, it's not really okay to go to LULAC meetings on work time. You better be doing that on your own time. So that's fine, because, you know, it's just a different sort of a culture. And I can actually respect that they might not see that as part of my job, or that some people might not. But I've been more than happy to do that work in my own time. And I can't imagine the whole of the work I do without it encompassing those aspects of it. So I think we're really on the same page there.
Thank you.
I have to make the microphone short there. So community work, and thank you for your presentations and your work. It's given, I think, all of us a lot to think about. The kind of community work that you do and others do requires that building of personal trust and individual trust. How in your work do you carry that individual trust forward to institutional trust? So when we talk about moving material collections into archives, that the foundation of that may be an interpersonal trust with one person or a few people in a department, but the long-term trust in the community and what happens when I leave, if I leave, what are your thoughts about how do you begin to instill that in your organization, your department, your community, so that while you may be building one-on-one trust and creating that relationship, that it's a broader relationship that can carry forward over time?
Can I say that that's a really smart question? I believe the community I'm working with, the Rural Civil Rights Project, they trust me and continue to not trust the university. I know, isn't that sad? So I'm constantly checking in with them. Here's what I have. Here's the story I'm constructing. What do you think about that? Where do you think this material should go? Who do you think should have access to it? How do we get it into spaces where that people will use it? And so I find that beginning that conversation early, that co-collaboration where I'm working with them to a degree, you know, and then there's this thing called the university, and we can negotiate with that, and we might not always get what we want or what we need. Like, one of the big things that folks are worried about with the stuff I'm collecting is, are you going to give it to SIU and they're going to, like, put it in, like, a corner for 10 years and, like, no one gets access to it, which is actually kind of maybe a real fear. So I haven't deposited my stuff there. So sometimes I have to make choices about where things might go or how I might help create connections based on those needs, because they've just given me their heart. They've just told me some of the most traumatic things that ever happened to them. I don't want that energy to go for naught.
Again, I think I'm in a different position because I'm in the UI libraries in the Iowa Women's Archives, so the material is coming into the physical repository. So for those people who have trusted us to preserve their history, we try very hard to encourage visits to the archives, one-on-one, family visits to look at papers in the archives, that the archives become part of the community, so that it's a two-way street. And we have events like the Mujeres Latinas, Every Woman Has a Story, so that people are finding new reasons to visit the archives. And the other thing I really like to do is to try to develop a relationship with the children of the older people who've donated materials and interviews, and then to keep that within the family, because then the archival repository becomes a communal place where everybody from the family can come and look at the family papers, and they need to know that they're always welcome. They need to know where we are, and they need to be in touch with other people who work in the archives, because, right, we go, and then there will be somebody else. And so they need to be very familiar with the institution and feel that they do trust us. I think that's very important.
Hello, this is for Professor Aguayo. Do you have any relationship with the archivists at your institution?
I've been to visit them several times. I haven't completely found those meetings productive. And this is why, for those of you who don't know about the state of Illinois and the intense, crazy, we haven't had a budget for 2 years. So universities are working off of fumes right now. We've used all our reserves. So the library staff has been whittled down for, 7-8 years, right? And the president before us was dismantling the library faculty. So there's not a lot of, there's not a lot of labor power there. And I think that many of you probably exist in universities and colleges where this is the case, right? There's all this kind of metadata you have to have associated with these files, and do they have the capacity to deal with digitized materials? And if they do, are they going to be able to have the capacity to transfer them to the next, whatever the next thing is that we're going to have? Can they put them online? So these, when I couldn't get really good answers to these questions, I decided just to kind of stay in a holding pattern. So I'm so glad to have met Janet here.
And so I've seen, talk to Special Collections.
Yeah, and so Janet's gonna help me with this problem. And yes,
best buddy.
Yes. So, yeah, so I mean, I'm really interested in this intersection of people's history, digitized materials, and how to keep those things in spaces that people can access them. So if anybody has any insights on that, please, I want to talk to you.
Hi, I like the answer about, because I had the same question about long-term sustainability. I'm trying to do something similar with reaching out to my community, but we're a very small repository with a staff of two. And so one person leaves, you're pretty much back to square one, and I have no way of guaranteeing that whoever, the way archives work is that you move around a lot and you usually don't stay your whole career. I have no idea whether that one person that fills my position will have the same interests that I do. And I was wondering what you've done to try to, codify, or at the institutional level, because it sounds like, you're reaching out to children of people in the community, but what are you doing at the institutional level to try to make plans long-term for the project? Does that make sense? It's sort of the difference between the community and internally guaranteeing that there will be some sort of long-term support.
That's you. I guess that's me.
Yeah.
I just feel very strongly that Special Collections and the Iowa Women's Archives is very much behind this, and the UI libraries. I, of course, have worked there for a long time, but someday I will retire, and I hope there will. My dream would be to see a Latina librarian in the Iowa Women's Archives doing a great deal more than I can do. I think it'd be fantastic. So there'll be change, and it'll get even better. It'll be great.
Okay, so I think we're out of time for questions. We have one more announcement from John Overholt. There he is.
Thank you.
So thanks very much. I'm John Overholt. I have the honor to be chair of RBMS this year. And I want to say thank you to our panelists. That was tremendous. I always say that one of my favorite things about the RBMS conference is the way it brings people together. So I'm so excited to hear it's happening right on this very stage. So I also want to extend the thanks of RBMS to the University of Iowa Libraries and Iowa State University Library for making this spectacular auditorium and reception space tonight available to us. The first time I visited Iowa City was on the scouting visit that we did to check out this place as a site for the conference, and I immediately thought, oh, this is going to be so great. And I hope you agree with me that from the venues to the people to the programs, Iowa City is crushing it.
Yeah.
I just couldn't be more pleased, and we're so grateful to all the members of the Local Arrangements Committee who have worked so very hard to make Iowa City incredibly welcoming to this conference, and it's been a fantastic experience. At this time, if he's available, I would like to introduce our dynamic chair of local arrangements and director of University of Iowa Special Collections, Greg Preckman.
Thank you, and welcome to Iowa. I hope everyone's having a good time. We've put a lot of work into this, and you know, you sketch out these outlines, and they're kind of an abstract thing, and then all of a sudden, people fill them out, and it becomes a real event, and it feels really good. So welcome to Iowa, where we build really nice things because, let's face it, we can't leave. The next time we travel to see you somewhere and we start going on about cancellations and connections and the weather and the shuttle, perhaps, you'll all just know, oh, yeah, I see that. Yeah. So hopefully, since the beginning of the conference, we've left you with a much better impression of Iowa City. And please make the effort to come and see us again sometime. So we would like to extend this event and all of the time that we've had together at a reception here at Hancher, where we can enjoy this beautiful new building. So I'd like to thank Iowa State University and Petrina, who personally made this happen too, for co-sponsoring. So the University of Iowa Libraries and Iowa State University Libraries would like to welcome you to a reception. What we're going to do is leave through the two back doors that most of you came in through, and then it's right up the stairs to the next level up, and there's stuff to eat and drink, and let's have some fun. Thanks.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.